Best of Times Radio Hour, live on 101.7 FM and 710 Keel, a show dedicated to seniors and boomers in Northwest Louisiana. Here's your host, Gary Kaligas.
Good morning, radio listeners. I'm Gary Kaligas, the publisher of The Best of Times, the only magazine and radio show for mature adults in Northwest Louisiana. I do thank you for tuning in to our show today, and also thanking those who might be listening via the internet at www.710keel.com. Also thanking those who might be listening via the Keel application on their Apple or Android devices. In addition, we want to thank those individuals who might be listening to this podcast on the bestoftimesnews.com or Apple Podcasts. We do thank AARP Louisiana Neighbors, Hunting Country of Shreveport, your Dodge, Chrysler, Ram, and Jeep dealer for being the exclusive sponsors of this radio show to provide you with beneficial information each and every Saturday morning. In just a few minutes, we're going to discuss the opioid settlement and the hope for the future. So stay tuned to our radio show to learn some interesting information. It is Saturday, January the 25th, and we are broadcasting our show from the studios of News Radio 710 Keel, a Town Square media station here in wonderful Shreveport, Louisiana. However, today's show has been pre-recorded, so we will be unable to accept calling questions and comments from our loyal radio listeners. Be sure to pick up the January-February 2025 issue of The Best of Times at one of our 270 distribution locations. We do thank you for the many compliments about our magazine. We do appreciate hearing from you. Remember, if you're unable to find a printed copy of our magazine at one of the 270 distribution locations, you can always visit our popular website at www.thebestoftimesnews.com to view both current and past issues, listen to previously broadcast radio shows here on the Best of Times Radio Hour. In addition, you can download the current 2024 Silver Pages from our website. In addition, you can learn about upcoming events and news that you can use. Speaking of Silver Pages, we are working on our 2025 edition of our Silver Pages Senior Resource Directory for Northwest Louisiana. This will be our 23rd edition of our most popular publication with our readers both in print and online. Again, this is the only senior resource directory available in Northwest Louisiana, both in print and online versions. We are updating it and have added a lot of beneficial information that you'll be able to reference for you, your loved ones, and others. If your business is interested in being part of our 2025 Silver Pages, please call us as soon as possible. 318-636-5510. Again, that's 318-636-5510. The 2025 Silver Pages will be released to the public on March the 1st of 2025. Each and every month, the Best of Times sends out a TBT newsletter via e-blast over 73,000 email addresses of seniors and boomers who reside in Caddo and Bossier parishes of Louisiana. It provides them with a link to read our current issue online, but also to read our current Silver Pages. In addition, there are more educational articles that are not found in our magazine, lots of discounts and coupons, a contest, and lots of news about upcoming events and other news that can benefit you and your loved ones. Join the many thousands who are receiving this free newsletter via the email address. Just visit our website at www.thebestoftimesnews.com to subscribe free of charge to receive this newsletter each and every month. We'll be right back with more information, but now a word from our sponsors and advertisers who do make this radio show possible. You're listening to the Best of Times Radio Hour here on News Radio 710 Keel, proudly presented by AARP Louisiana and Abears Tenant Country of Shreveport, your Dodge, Chrysler, Ram, and Jeep dealer.
The Best of Times Radio Hour will be right back on 101.7 FM and 710 Keel. Back to the Best of Times Radio Hour on 101.7 FM and 710 Keel.
Welcome back to our show, the Best of Times Radio Hour, proudly presented by AARP Louisiana and Abears Tenant Country of Shreveport, your Dodge, Chrysler, Ram, and Jeep dealer. Joining me on my show today as a very special guest is Dr. Sean McNeil, who is a clinical professor and researcher at Louisiana Addiction Research Center at the Ochsner LSU Health here in Shreveport. I've asked him to come on our show to discuss a little bit about the opioid settlement and the hope for the future for betterment for all individuals. So thank you, Doc, for taking time to join us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So, you know, it's an important topic. I think a lot of people have put it aside because of all the news in prior years. It's like, but it's, you know, it's still happening, right? It's still happening.
Yeah.
Opioid addiction is still happening, right?
It is. And, you know, I think the problem that we see, and some people call it an epidemic, some people call it a crisis. I think it started off innocently enough. You know, we had these really incredible medicines that could be used for treating pain, and plenty of patients have pain. Which is understandable, and so you have these forces kind of pushing towards more treatment. You know, you have patients who are in pain asking for medications. There are the drug companies who, of course, would like to sell more product, you know, from a business standpoint. And then you kind of have the doctors in the middle, and they're trying to do the best thing for their patient. They sometimes have a tough choice to make. And so I think that we started seeing a trend towards, treating more conditions with these opioid pain medicines and maybe using them for a longer duration of time than they really need to be used. And, you know, that's kind of a recipe for the addiction crisis that we see because, you know, these people become habituated or addicted to these medicines. Over time, they become very dependent on the effects of the medicines, and that's where it comes from.
Well, Doc, what was before opioids? Have opioids been around 100 years or 10 years?
They've been around for decades. Really the opioids, if you look, there's plants, derivatives that contain opioids. So there are naturally occurring opioids. And, of course, people have used these here and there in spots around the world for a long time.
Right.
But I don't think it became used internationally until, I wouldn't say the past few decades, but, you know, certainly within the past 100 years, it's become more of an international issue because they're used internationally at this point. And Big Pharma has had a lot to do with, you know, getting these medicines across the globe. And again, I don't want to, you know, paint it as all negative. There are people that certainly need pain medications. The medicines have their indications, but we just have to be very judicious about how we use the medicines because we don't want people becoming addicted.
But before this, there were other medications that you could take to help relieve or symptoms, you know, to help to relieve the pain in some sorts.
There are other forms of pain relief, but these medicines work specifically on these opioid receptors that you have in your brain and actually throughout your body. And specifically, there's this mu opioid receptor. There are different types of opioid receptors, but there's some amount of pleasure you can get from having the opioid receptor stimulated, and so there's some amount of pain relief, but also there's kind of a pleasure aspect to the medication, and so I think that's something else that plays into the addictive potential of these drugs is potential pleasure you can get from using them.
So, Doc, I can tell you I've never taken this, but to relieve pain, I hear, most people take Tylenol, take Advil, take all the other other types of, and, occasionally steroids, but so this is at higher level, right?
Yeah, so these are generally thought to be more potent, but sometimes they are combined. Like, for instance, you mentioned Tylenol or acetaminophen. Sometimes these opioids are combined with acetaminophen in one pill. And so, you can combine different types of pain relievers, and really I think a good clinician could use that to their advantage in order to use less opioids. Maybe they could combine with another type of pain medication when it's appropriate.
So when it first came out, doctors got the education by the pharmaceutical companies, their reps, to saying this is the way to treat certain individuals that are having chronic pain or acute pain. What was the definition?
Right. Well, I don't think it was their only source of education, but certainly pharmaceutical reps come out and do try to teach clinicians about the potential uses for their medicine, what the FDA has approved it for. So, I mean, I do think there's some amount of educating that does happen in that way where, you know, pharmaceutical companies do have a voice in educating clinicians about their product. But, there's this concept of pain as a vital sign. So vitals typically include your blood pressure, your heart rate, your temperature. But there was this concept that pain could be thought of as a vital sign. So, you know, basically the idea was put out that, you know, a clinician isn't doing a complete job unless they've assessed your level of pain and treated pain. And there was this concept that pain is that important to treat that we should treat it like a vital sign. And so I do think that we've gotten away from that mentality somewhat because of the opioid crisis. But that is perhaps a concept that was maybe pushed or encouraged by some of the pharmaceutical companies at the time. And I do think that's to some extent where a lot of the controversy comes from because of the ways that it was marketed, the way that pain medications were marketed, and the way that they, kind of encouraged clinicians to think of pain as something that, you know, had to be treated at all costs and, you know, to the greatest extent possible.
But, yeah, again, you're a young doctor, but I'm sure you probably might remember. I can't remember if you were practicing back then, but I was told by doctors in the 1990s they didn't have that pain scale from 0 to 10. And that's right. When it got introduced around that time, right?
Right. And you know, it's really kind of a tough scale to use consistently. It's such a subjective scale, you know.
Right, patients, I was going to mention that.
It's really completely reliant on patient report. And to be honest with you, pain is difficult to fully assess. You know, you're relying on the patient giving you accurate information. And so it really helps to know your patient well. And I think that it can help to have really, really good rapport with your patients so they're giving you really accurate information. And that way you know them better and you can kind of assess, you know, if their pain is getting better or worse.
And if they're saying, you know, I have a 1, but actually it's a 9, but you don't know. I mean, it's so subjective. Every time I visit the doctors and they know me real well, and the nurses ask, what's your pain level today? Yeah. I think it's a 0 or a 1. He says, Well, hardly anybody has a 0. You could have some pain, don't you? No, I really don't. So it's so subjective from that scale.
It is. And there are objective measures. You know, you can look at how a patient is reacting when you move certain parts of their body, when you press for tenderness.
You can
assess if they're really experiencing pain, but it's not always reliable, and people have different kinds of pain. So there are some broad categories of pain. There's musculoskeletal pain. Some people also have nerve pain. So, you know, there are certain medicines that are kind of geared towards different types of pain as well, and that kind of muddies the water a little bit.
So would the opioids help in treating pain conditions of any parts of the body, from nerve endings, from neuropathy, et cetera? It was a general blanket type description?
They were often used that way, although I do think they are probably more suited for the musculoskeletal type pain, and there's a lot of very specific medicines now for nerve pain that we use. But, you know, again, a lot of people experience both, or they experience, you know, a very, like, kind of a hybrid type of pain. So, you know, it's really a tough to assess in certain cases.
So initially when somebody visited their doctor and they think they had an 8 or 9 and based upon some feelings, a personal examination, the physician validated that. So that's when the opioids were prescribed in a lower dose or whatever type, different dosages. And but you were saying the other factor, did the pharmaceutical companies, everybody know it was that addictive that you would have to be totally dependent? You kept wanting more and more?
Right. So I'm not sure at what point, you know, people started to realize how addictive these medicines were. But, you know, I think it does become obvious. So the way we define an addiction, or we really call them substance use disorders, and there is an opioid use disorder. The way we define most of these use disorders is we look at, the effects that the medicine is having on you, but in particular, we're looking at the effects from when you stop using. So, you know, if you stop using a substance and you have a withdrawal or you have cravings to where it starts to impact your daily life, that's kind of a warning sign. Also, with addictive substances, we tend to develop tolerance. So, you know, tolerance means that you need more and more of something to get the same effect. And we do see that with a lot of people that use pain medicines. They often ask for more and more because they can grow tolerant over time. And that is one of the problems because we're not just worried about the addiction or the long-term addiction of these substances, but in the short term, people that are using too many opioids can really face some problems. You know, they can have respiratory suppression. They can use so many opioids or such a high concentration that it can stop their breathing. And that's one of the acute effects that we're most worried about. And that's where a lot of the opioid deaths come from, is people that are essentially overdosing. You know, but that overdose, I think it happens. It's more likely to happen because of the tolerance that people are having, where they need more and more.
So they've taken it over a period and they got tolerance over it, and they still want more and more, right?
Right, oh. Right. And that can happen with pharmaceutical medications, but also people can use opioids from the streets and sometimes turn to those opioids from the street, things like heroin and fentanyl, because either they can't get their prescription anymore or the prescription isn't strong enough and they need something stronger, so they use street drugs, street opioids to, kind of satisfy their cravings and take account of their tolerance that they've built up.
So explain to our listeners the difference in street opioids and regular prescription. What's the difference?
Well, oftentimes what you'll find on the street is very potent. You know, you've probably, or your listeners have probably heard about fentanyl. Sometimes it's so strong that, a very small amount can do a lot of damage. You know, it can some people die from, too much contact, certainly from using more than they had expected. Sometimes they don't realize how much they're actually using. They're very potent. And also sometimes the way that you would take them, a prescription opioid typically involves a pill. However, on the streets, it's very likely that some people will inject things like heroin. Sometimes because of how fast it takes effect. When you inject it, it takes effect faster. But also, that introduces a lot of risk. When you're injecting things, now there's a risk for infection. There's a risk that you could miss your blood vessel and, get it into your into other tissues in your body. There's all kinds of complications. And when you're using dirty needles, sometimes there's a risk for spreading things like what would traditionally be thought of as sexually transmitted diseases you can get from sharing needles sometimes. And so there's a whole host of other risks that come about when you're using street drugs.
Interesting. So when did whoever was monitoring this determine it became a crisis? When was this?
To be honest, I'm not sure of the exact date that, it became a crisis. But I do believe that the DEA, who monitors these types of prescriptions, they certainly notice trends. And, there are certain pharmacies that would be prescribing such a high number of opioids that, would flag – it would come to the DEA's attention. I've heard stories of these of a pair of pharmacies in West Virginia that were prescribing extremely high numbers of opioids, more than what would be prescribed in some entire cities. Now, of course, there's a big blue collar population up in West Virginia, a lot of coworkers and people that have a lot of musculoskeletal pain, but it was still out of proportion to what you would expect. And I think seeing that happen at various pharmacies eventually tipped the DEA off, and so that they knew a problem was developed.
So the utilization was extremely high, but based upon the population, the probability of that.
Right. And clinicians, I do think, probably in their own practices, probably were noticing this trend as well.
And so, again, there was some crisis involved where these physicians or whoever networking were getting lots of these and then probably be selling them elsewhere, right? Without prescriptions.
Well, that's probably happens in some circumstances, and so I do think at some point the DEA tried to rein it in, and there are examples of where the DEA has gone after certain doctors who were certainly prescribing too many pain medications, and there's even Netflix documentaries about this, okay. So that people can find, but But I think that it kind of came to a head, and it came to the public's attention, and eventually it was obvious that something had to be done about it.
So when a physician, I'm just asking hypothetical questions mm-hmm. here. So if a physician ordered some opioids for his individual patients, mm-hmm. and he saw that individual lady or gentleman coming back, would he notice if she was or he was addicted or needed more? He kept pressing the doc, I need more of this, right?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think that a lot of clinicians would pick up on that, but they may not realize it's a problem. I will say that, you know, my background's in psychiatry. So after med school, I did my residency in psychiatry. And we help a lot of people that have a substance use disorder. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's very, I think seeing the template of addiction is very obvious to us because we see it a lot. But I think there's a lot of clinicians that see it, you know, just often enough that maybe they don't catch the pattern. And they, you know, often feel like they're, you know, helping the patient. So sometimes it's hard to deny the patient. But I think it's in many cases it becomes obvious over time that there's a problem developing.
Well, Doc, I've heard that in the past if physicians were proactive and wanted them, they would find another doctor to prescribe it for them, right?
Well, that may be the case. And I think that's where, like, larger regulatory groups come in because, you know, these prescriptions need to be monitored. And like I mentioned, the DEA, but we even have our own state branch. We have this thing called the Louisiana Board of Pharmacy, and they monitor controlled substances that are prescribed within the state. And so I think, the groups like the Board of Pharmacy and the DEA have a huge role to play in watching trends. And, you know, if there is one prescriber that everyone seems to be going to because they prescribe mm-hmm. more liberally these types of medicines, I think it's really important that these regulatory
true.
Bodies pick up on these patterns. Because, you know, there are some doctors who will self-regulate or who are very good at noticing the trend and self-regulating, but there are others that just may not notice it in time until there's a problem and they have a patient that's in crisis.
Okay, quick follow-up question. Is this opioid crisis or concern, did it hit Europe? I never heard anybody say anything about it. Did it hit Europe as well as, you know, you mainly hear it about the United States of America, but did it hit Europe as well?
So it's a worldwide problem, but there are certain countries where, you know, the market is much better controlled. So as far as pharmaceuticals go, but, you know, there are certainly countries all around the world where opium or opioid products are grown, places like Afghanistan. And so there are certainly people that have an addiction problem there, but it's not centered around prescription opioids, so it's really hard to quantify. But it's certainly a trend that we see in various places all around the world, including Europe.
Okay. Hold that thought. We'll be right back with more information, but now a word from our sponsors and advertisers who do make this radio show possible. You're listening to the Best of Times Radio Hour here on News Radio 710 Keel, proudly presented by AARP Louisiana and Hebert's Town and Country of Shreveport, your Dodge, Chrysler, Ram, and Jeep dealer.
The Best of Times Radio Hour will be right back on 101.7 FM and 710 Keel. Now back to the Best of Times Radio Hour on 101.7 FM at 710 Keel.
Welcome back to our show, the Best of Times Radio Hour, proudly presented by AARP Louisiana and Hebert's Town and Country of Shreveport, your Dodge, Chrysler, Ram, and Jeep dealer. Joining me on my show today is a very special guest, is Dr. Sean McNeil, a clinical professor and researcher at Louisiana Addiction Research Center at Ossner LSU Health here in Shreveport. Thank you, Doc, for taking time to join our show today.
Yeah, thank you.
I forgot to ask you, give us a little overview of yourself and your medical experience. You mentioned it quickly, but tell our listeners, are they always fascinated? Where were you born and raised? And where?
Okay, well, born in Kentucky. Raised between Kentucky and Georgia, and then I moved to this area for residency. So after medical school, you complete a residency.
Right.
I did mine in psychiatry, which is mental health, and I did a fellowship in child and adolescent psychiatry. So I treat adults and kids, and then later on became board certified also in addiction medicine. So I really do enjoy treating patients that. Have, sometimes very profound conditions, really, you know, severe addictions. I think it's really gratifying to see them get better. Sometimes these patients are really stuck in their situation. And so that's what I enjoy doing. My clinical work is mostly at Louisiana Behavioral Health, which is it's like a partnership between Ochsner, Oceans, and LSU Health. And I'm the chief medical officer at that hospital. And then, of course, at the medical school, I'm in the program director for the psychiatry residency. So we help train residents who are going into psychiatry. And then also at the medical center, we do a lot of research. So you mentioned the Louisiana Addiction Research Center. We have a lot of very dedicated researchers, you know, at the facility. We're working on stimulant. We have a lot of stimulant projects, so people that may be addicted to, like, say, methamphetamines. But we're looking increasingly at opioids, projects related to opioid addiction, opioid abuse.
Oh, okay.
So, but some of our more exciting stuff that we've done lately actually focuses around the use of psilocybin as a treatment.
What's that?
Psilocybin is a compound that, you know, people are very familiar with it being a compound found in mushrooms.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, some people use it in order to have almost a spiritual experience.
I've heard of that, yes.
They use it to kind of have a trip. But, you know, there are some researchers, some of our colleagues at University of Alabama, Birmingham, who are actually using it to treat people that are addicted to cocaine.
Oh.
And so we're hoping to use it here in this area for people addicted to methamphetamines, and it would be great if we saw some good results. So that project is just on the cusp of enrolling patients.
Well, I hope you get enough patients in the study that can be beneficial. That's sometimes difficult, these clinical studies, right?
Yeah, thank you.
So let me know if I can help in any way. I don't know how I can help and broadcast that, but you need to let people aware of it. Hopefully you get more and more. It's important to get that in a control group, correct?
Oh, absolutely.
So going back to the opioid crisis, are some of the reasons people were becoming addictive and further was they were unaware that they were addicted to this and was causing issues?
Yeah. So I think, you know, again, often a person's addiction to opioids starts off with treatment. Now, it doesn't have to, but, you know, oftentimes people are prescribed an opioid and take it for a duration of time that allows this habituation to develop. Again, sometimes they'll start using it from friends or get it off the street, and that's how the addiction develops. But, you know, sometimes it is because they are prescribed the medication. And so they don't always realize that they're, you know, the addictive potential of what they're taking.
So when that occurs, hopefully them or their loved ones can get them referred to help hopefully treat that, correct?
Right.
And
yeah.
Most of the time that doesn't happen or didn't happen in the early years?
Well, I think that it depends entirely on the person and how ready they are to change. And that's something we talk a lot about with any kind of addiction, is how ready they are to change. Some people are very comfortable within their addiction. You know, they want to keep using. You know, it gives them such pleasure. Sometimes it gives them an identity. Being around the other people that use gives them an identity. So it's hard to make the choice to change. And so one of the first things we do is we try to assess people's readiness to change. Now, if they're coming to you for help, then that's really a great sign. But sometimes they're coming to you and they haven't even thought about stopping. And our job as a clinician is to try to assess where they're at and try to move them forward towards this pathway. You know, before they've thought about it, we call this period pre-contemplation. So they haven't even thought about
changing.
Okay. And then they might move into you can help them move along into the contemplation stage, and then they can start to plan. You know, the hope is that we get them to plan and then actively be a part of that change process.
What's the encouraging moment that you tell these individuals? You show them what could happen in the future? Do you give them worst-case scenarios?
Yeah. Well, I think that should be part of our treatment, is we always have to educate them on the realistic outcomes, you know, what can happen if they don't stop using. But a lot of times we're looking at what motivates them. You know, we ask them questions like, you know, from a scale of 0 to 10, how much do you want to change? And if they say a 4, you ask them, why is it a 4 and not a 5? Or why is it a 4 and not a 7? And you try to figure out a way to get them to a higher, you know, a higher motivation for change. And you try to see, you know, if you're motivated by your kids, or if you're motivated by your family or your work, you know, we want to focus in on that, you know, because they can use that as motivation. They just don't realize it, you know. So, but we can be a part of pointing this out to them. Like, you have a lot to live for. Let's find what you have to live for, and let's focus on that, and let's use that as the impetus for change.
So, Dr. McNeil, what else can you tell them if their opioid addiction is? Is there a solution by alternative drug that can help relieve the pain and give them the same relief?
Yeah, so there are definitely medications that we use in helping these patients. So first and foremost, we want to think about safety. So as I mentioned, one of the more grave consequences is they could overdose and stop breathing. So we want to make sure that patients that may have an opioid addiction have access to something called Narcan, okay. Naloxone. It's in Louisiana, there's a standing prescription, so you can go to any pharmacy and purchase it. And really, it should be carried on the person at all times. If we're really wanting them to be safe. Another thing is, if someone, a patient of mine, has a family member that has an opioid addiction, you can prescribe it to that family member, so that they can use it if their loved one has an overdose. So you just want Narcan around. We even have a program at the medical school where employees and students can actually get Narcan so they can have it on their person if they encounter a patient who is overdosing.
Not to be unfamiliar, is it an injection or a pill?
Well, so they have a nasal version where you spray up the nose, and then they also have an injectable version that you can shoot into their thigh. Typically, that's where it's shot. But I do see the nasal version being used more by, like, law enforcement. So typically, that's how you'll encounter it. And it pretty quickly, it's a opioid antagonist. So it quickly goes to those opioid receptors we talked about, mm-hmm. and it blocks those opioid receptors. And so it keeps the the drug from having its effects. Now, it can induce a withdrawal, but we're not so worried about the withdrawal at that point. You know, if someone's about to overdose, we're just worried about keeping them alive. And so we want to stop the overdose from progressing.
So give our listeners out there, what's an indication of somebody overdosing?
So, you know, it's helpful if you know that person, if you know their history. So if they're, for example, if you know that they're using an opioid and then they start to have some behavioral changes, like they start slumping over, they look like they're almost a zombie, they're kind of falling over, they can't sit up straight, they can't walk straight, especially if you notice that they're not breathing much, mm-hmm. you know, their respiratory rate is slowing down. These are pretty specific signs that a person might be experiencing an opioid overdose.
So are majority of those type people hopefully taken to ER as quickly as
right.
possible?
Yeah, so many of these patients, a lot of times people on the street that might see this person, that they don't have Narcan, but they call 911. So first responders will come and either give them Narcan on the scene or in the ambulance. They'll try to revive them on the way to the ER. And so, you know, unfortunately, sometimes it's too late, but I've had a lot of patients that come in having recently been revived with mm-hmm. Narcan, and then they're treated in the ER because, of course, they're not in the best physical state at that point. And sometimes, you know, they'll end up coming to the psychiatric facility for a while, and we'll try to figure out what else is going on with them. So, you know, we're just kind of focused on recovery at that point, getting them hooked up with resources that are going to help them.
So as in any medical technology and medical change, Narcan must be pretty new. It hasn't been around for years and years, has it?
I'm not sure of the exact date, but yeah, it's fairly new. I don't
so
even
that
remember
was
it being...
a wonder. Before then, there was nothing else known, right?
There was nothing like Narcan. No, I mean, there's nothing that you know, people just carried on them to revive these types of patients, you know. But the opioid problem wasn't as profound earlier on either, so I feel like, you know, the treatments have kind of caught up to the need because opioid overdose is so rampant now, but it would still help for it to have more people educated, and it would help to have Narcan in as many people's hands as possible so they know how to use it appropriately.
Well, that's what a couple of listeners wanted to ask you. Mm-hmm. Is it still around? We don't hear about the opioid crisis or as much as we have in the news media and throughout. I mean, we haven't heard as much about it.
Well, although we see it all over the place, it is very regional. So, you know, what I find is, like, very urban places tend to struggle more with the opioid crisis, at least street opioids. Very rural places oftentimes still struggle with, you know, the actual pharmaceutical opioid problem. You know, there may not be as much heroin in a small community, but there, you know, some people might find a way to access pills. So it is still a problem. And you can actually go to the website, the Louisiana Department of Health website, and you can actually see a trend line of the opioid problem. It is still an increasing problem, but you're right.
Which was amazing. I mean, yeah. When I looked at it, I was like, I thought it was possibly solved, but no. Yeah.
No, and at the same time, overdoses of, and it's harder to overdose on a stimulant, but overdoses of methamphetamines and cocaine are also going up. So, you know, we just see this general trend, even though our state population is not necessarily increasing at a high rate, we do see a continued increase in the trend of overdose deaths.
And quickly explain, I mean, I've had people understand that we penalized all these companies, the pharmaceutical company and distributor, you know, $26 billion. So what did that go? Did it go to the government? Did it go to where was the $26 billion? Who got it?
Good question. So, yeah, you're referring to this opioid settlement. It's a really historic settlement, although we've seen a similar settlement in the past. When Big Tobacco was sued, there was a big class action suit. There was like a $200 billion settlement, but a lot of the money didn't go towards treating tobacco addiction, you know, unfortunately. And so this money, although it was only $26 billion, that's still a lot of money.
Yes.
But it was earmarked a little better. So it's specifically intended for programs and services and research that help to address opioid addiction and the crisis. So I can tell you here locally, like every county and parish in America was essentially designated a certain amount of funds.
Okay, good. Now,
some parishes or counties aren't, you know, they don't have a big academic center. So, you know, they may not be able to use the funds. So some of the funds can go to other parishes or counties. Like, for example, in our area, LSU Health Shreveport is a very large academic center. So if we're able to help out other parishes and counties, we can utilize their funds. And the goal that, you know, we have in mind is using these funds for creating programs and services. And like I said, addiction research projects that help to kind of stem the tide with the opioid crisis.
Well, that's good that they go to the and actually going to implement some change and hopefully for the positive as well, right?
Right. Yeah, and what we don't want to see is this money being, you know, used in inappropriate ways or being used for conditions that are not, you know, related to the opioid addiction crisis.
Right. I'll hold that thought. We'll be right back with more information, but now a word from our sponsors and advertisers who do make this radio show possible. You're listening to the Best of Times Radio Hour here on News Radio 710 Keel, proudly presented by AARP Louisiana Neighborson and Country of Shreveport, your Dodge, Chrysler, Ram, and Jeep dealer.
The Best of Times Radio Hour will be right back on 101.7 FM and 710 Keel. Back to the Best of Times Radio Hour on 101.7 FM at 710 Keel.
Welcome back to our show, the Best of Times Radio Hour, proudly presented by AARP Louisiana Neighborstown and Country of Shreveport, your Dodge, Chrysler, Ram, and Jeep dealer. Joining me on my show today as a special guest is Dr. Sean McNeil, who is a clinical professor and researcher at Louisiana Addiction Research Center at Ochsner LSU Health here in Shreveport. I've asked him to come on our show to discuss the opioid settlement and the hope for the future. So thank you, Doc, for taking time to be in our show. So what is your feelings about the hope for the future? Is it a positive nature?
Well, we certainly have options. So we discussed how to treat someone in crisis, but there are a lot of very specialized clinics helping to treat people that are addicted and they know they have a problem with addiction. So,
and all types of addiction. We're not talking, right?
Right. But now specifically with the opioids, there are oftentimes they're called methadone clinics, but they quite increasingly offer methadone or buprenorphine. So these are two medications. Methadone is what we call an opioid agonist. So it binds to opioid receptors the same way that opioid pills bind. But it can be more controlled and regulated. So the patient can go to a methadone clinic and they can have a very set amount of methadone given to them. And, you know, over time they can work with their doctor to start tapering it down slowly so they can work on their addiction. Some of them struggle chronically and they stay on methadone for a long period of time. And then there's buprenorphine and it's called a partial agonist. So, you know, it does bind to opioid receptors, but I would say it has a little bit less of an effect than the methadone does. So it doesn't fully come in and hit all your opioid receptors. So it doesn't have the full effect that, say, taking your heroin or fentanyl from the street would have, but it has a little bit of opioid effect, and it does also help people, you know, with their addiction, their craving. Some people stay on it long term, but some people taper down and get off, you know, are able to get off opioids by using a medicine like this. And then there's another medicine out there that once you're off opioids, you have to be off for at least a week because you don't want to withdraw. But once you've successfully gotten off opioids for a week, it actually helps you with your cravings. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, and it can also kind of make you a little bit sick if you try to use opioids on top of it. It's called naltrexone, and it's a daily medicine, but it also has a shot version that lasts for a whole month. So if you're not good about taking it daily, or you don't feel like you can be accountable to yourself to take it daily, if you think you might relapse, if you can just make that commitment once a month to getting your shot, it's very helpful for patients.
So what are the indications for that?
So you can actually use it for opioid use disorder or alcohol use disorder.
Oh,
so
it's alcohol useful, use disorder.
It's useful for both. And the only downside is you need a liver that functions pretty well. So you have to, you know, see your doctor and make sure you don't have a chronic liver disease or a significant liver problem. But I would say other than a little bit of nausea, I've really not had patients have any trouble taking naltrexone. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's been a very good medication.
So tell us about the formation of the Louisiana Addiction Research Center at LSU, right?
Okay, yeah. So, you know, I've been around LSU for a while. I did my residency training here, so I've been here since 2013 in Shreveport specifically. And we didn't have this, you know, when I was a resident. But, yeah, it seemed increasingly necessary that we start studying addiction, especially here in our region. And so in 2021, I believe, the Louisiana Addiction Research Center was formed. And, you know, what it does is it kind of seeks to bring together all the resources that the medical center has. But we certainly reach out and collaborate with people from other places to get some of this research done. So I'll give you an example, that psilocybin project I talked about earlier. We're working with Uprising Rehab. We've worked with CADA Rehab on some other projects.
Okay, CADA.
And so, you know, I think that there's a huge potential for us to engage the community in that way, just in research projects. But like I mentioned, as that opioid settlement money is being used, there's a potential for us to create services to help the community, education programs to help the community, all through LARC, the research center.
So, Doc, when these research studies come up with an idea and they're going through all, mm-hmm. what's the outcome? Is the outcome given to clinicians and people throughout the United States and the world?
Yeah, well, research, it's tricky. I think it's good to think of research as a pipeline. You know, it starts off as a concept. You know, you move into starting to see patients. And sometimes you work with company like pharma companies, for example. There is a company creating a psilocybin project, and that's another. We have a project in the pipeline. It's for postpartum depression, using small doses of psilocybin to treat women with severe postpartum depression. But yeah, we kind of move from the theoretical to the research, and then we start to you know, look through the research findings. You know, unfortunately, there's all this takes time. So even if we start seeing good results, you know, it generally takes seeing results at lots of different sites before, you know, a company will then move to try to get FDA approval for an indication. For, like I mentioned, University of Alabama, Birmingham is using psilocybin for cocaine addiction. We're using it for meth addiction. You know, perhaps one day if our sites and a few other sites pulled all their data together, some company wanting to market a psilocybin project may then be able to go to the FDA and say, look at this data, and the FDA would consider it, you know, to see if it's something that could actually be prescribed by any doctor. But at least, you know, in the short term, at least if you're around a big medical center, you could potentially get your loved one into a research project, you know, that shows some promise. So you might have early access to these kind of programs.
Except sometimes you get the placebo and you may get the real stuff, correct, Doc?
So many trials do have a placebo arm where there's a control group. But
it has sometimes a scintilla effect. I've known individuals get in and they didn't get it. they didn't really have it, but they felt great. So absolutely. As a sentinel effect.
Yeah, you can get some benefit just from the placebo. There's data showing that. Yeah. But yeah, I'm excited by our pipeline of projects, but you know, there are things I'm sure that we haven't considered yet. You know, new studies that we may conceive of in the future. I'm just glad that LARC, our research center, exists and that it's growing and more addiction-centric professionals are becoming a part of it.
Well, that, you know, that's important. I mean, research, you've got to come from somewhere. But where do the ideas come from for researchers? Is it given, do you see what somebody's doing in California or New York?
Yeah.
And that's how y'all determine, let's do it here in Shreveport?
It can happen that way. Sometimes it comes from strategic collaborations with other institutions. Sometimes, you know, we'll have our committee meetings where we discuss projects. Sometimes there are projects that our researchers conceive of all on their own, and which that's very rewarding when you see a project like that take off and yield good results.
Well, and you know, you need to tell listeners, sometimes there's good and sometimes they're bad. Sometimes it didn't come out to what you thought it.
Yeah.
And the concept didn't, after all the studies and all the information, it's not the right thing, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, true. You know, but we try to be very careful because, you know, when you've invested so much, you want to make sure that you've done your homework and made sure it's a viable project before you've invested too much time and effort into it, and money. You know, I do think that we have pretty good direction with the leadership of LARC. So I think that's helpful. And there's a lot of again, very talented people up at the medical center helping push some of this research forward.
Well, mention to our listeners, I saw in your article, but also we put in our Silver Pages, our resource directory, and all, is promoting 988.
Mm-hmm.
That's not really heavily promoted in our area, do you think?
You're right. I don't think enough people know about it. I try to educate all of my patients before they leave the hospital. And on a daily basis, I treat teenagers on a mental health unit. And so I try to
explain to them what that is.
Yeah, so 988, and it only started out in certain states, but it's a national mental health hotline. So, you know, for anyone in mental health crisis, some people call it a suicide hotline, but really you can call with any mental health crisis. And it works anywhere in the country now. It's a national number. So just like 911 works across the country, 988 will work, and you can talk to a crisis professional. They can help you decide. They can talk with you, and they can help you decide what to do next. You know, they can help dispatch law enforcement if that's what's needed. So 988, I think is good to know about. And also locally, within Louisiana, I think people need to know about utilizing the coroner's office. If you know, have a loved one that is in a mental health crisis, call the coroner's office, and they can potentially dispatch law enforcement to go do a safety mental health check on that patient.
Didn't know that. Okay. So 988, we need to promote that for mental health crisis within a family member or other. They can yeah, call that.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure they do the triage there to determine the factors involved, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I've had patients call it before, and a lot of times it's because they really needed to be in the hospital, and they usually find a way into the hospital. They help them get services they need.
Well, thank you again for taking time to join our show today. It was quite educational. I know I learned a lot, and I'm sure many thousands of radio listeners out there definitely appreciate it. So thank you, Doc, for taking time to be on our show today.
Absolutely. I appreciate the chance to be here.
Everyone, hope you join us next Saturday for another show that could benefit you or your loved ones. Don't forget to pick up your personal copy of The Best of Times at one of our 210 locations. May God bless you and your family. God bless America. Have a great day and a great weekend. Thank you again for listening to our show. I'm Gary Kaligas, wishing you and yours the best of times, both today and every day. Have a great day.